Hello, it is May 29th, 2014. This is episode 424 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on Sports on Earth. Today's death, Jeff Buckley, who died May 29th, 1997. After the death of his father, Tim Buckley, a renowned jazz guitarist who died of a drug overdose and whom Buckley had met only once, Jeff changed his father's last name, changed to his father's last name, and spent years as a hired guitarist for various bands, often doing cover shows at weddings. It wasn't until a show honoring that father at a tribute concert that Buckley finally broke through, impressing record executives and recording with the band Gods and Monsters. He left that band shortly thereafter and went solo, recording the album Grace. Jimmy Page said Grace was the best album of the decade. Bob Dylan said Buckley was one of the great songwriters of this decade. And David Bowie said it was the one album he'd take with him on a desert island. He continued as a critical success, but never broke though over into the mainstream success that many felt was coming when one evening in Memphis, he went swimming on the banks of the Mississippi River. A roadie was with him, and when the roadie turned around for a moment, when he turned back, Buckley was gone. 5 days later, his body was found downriver with no alcohol or no drugs or no sign of any of that. He was 30 years old. Here in Athens, though, it is merely Thursday. I'm Will Leach. I thank you for spending part of your day with me. It is the last show of the week. We have two more weeks of shows before I'm going to go on a little break for no reason other than, you know, there's personal business going on. We'll put it that way. But nothing bad. I don't have cancer or anything. I mean, that would be awful. Anyway, but just take a little break there. But we'll be back after that. We're going to basically spend one more week of shows, regular schedule next week, and then the week from the 9th to the 12th, we are going to preview the crap out of the World Cup. We're going to do a lot of World Cup stuff. And then we'll still do some shows in the next couple of weeks after that. It's just going to be a little bit of a hectic time for me personally. So we're going to have to fight through that. So it won't be a regular. It's the summer. You should be out playing anyway. Anyway, last show of this week. Delighted to have on as our guest today Mr. Paul Papps, producer of the Dan Patrick Radio Show and a fellow fellow product of the state of Illinois' public university system. He went to Southern Illinois. I went to the University of Illinois. And I bet he got better grades than me. Anyway, here's Paul. First off, Mr. Papps, thanks for coming on with me. It's an honor. Every time I talk to someone, you know, I talk to a lot of writers on this show, or I'll talk to occasional athlete on the show, and I get nervous when I talk to actual broadcast professionals like yourself, because as you know, perhaps as vividly as anyone, I am not a broadcast professional, and so please bear with me through all the stumblings and the crazy fast talking.
Well, let's get right into it. That harkens back to about 4 years ago when you and AJ DeLorio of Deadspin filled in for Dan Patrick, and I always wanted to do that. I always wanted to take one of the guys who works for the major blogs and say, here's what it's like to be in the big seat and see what it's like, because you know, everyone's job is really tough, no matter what you do in the media industry. And trying out someone else's job, I think, gives you a new respect for it. And you guys did very well. AJ was a little, I guess aloof would be the word. He was kind of looking around a lot during the show. You were more focused and really kind of grinding it out.
Yeah, well, you know, listen, I'll be honest with you. Now that I did that, it's totally easy. I don't understand what everyone's talking about. No, I do remember that. It was actually about 5 years ago, if you can believe that. And it is funny because that was, I remember that. You know, we felt, you know, we knew you guys well enough that, like, we knew you were having fun with us, but not trying to actually, like, completely screw us.
We would never do that. We would never punk you or put you in a position to fail. Like, as a producer, I was trying to do everything to give you guys a good show to work with. But it was interesting because when I brought up your names, Dan Patrick goes, yeah, sure, that sounds pretty interesting. I brought it up to some of the people in management. They're like, wait, those guys, they, you know, a lot of people in the, back then, I would say, you and AJ were somewhat toxic to the stiff suits.
Yeah, well, I don't think I'm. I mean, I don't know if I'm particularly aromatic for them now. certainly, I think that I do remember. And of course, that was the time too, where I'd been gone from Deadspin for about a year at that point.
Right.
And I remember because You know, that was one of the time you were always kind of in a defensive crouch anytime anyone asked you anything. You know, anytime, because that was still in the particular, that was right before AJ really started like throwing those bombs at ESPN like that. So back before he became really toxic, and me by not being at Deadspin anymore, it was amazing the number of people that came to me and said, "Wow, Will, we had no idea how nice we had it when you were there." And and which is why I feel like Craig, and I loved AJ's Deadspin, I love Craig's Deadspin, but I do feel like Craig's is the platonic ideal of how Deadspin should go. Throwing bombs, but throwing very focused bombs, as opposed to being the total, I guess, in retrospect, kind of a wimp.
Well, I've always wondered that, you know, you were the face of Deadspin and the name on Deadspin for years. And I was wondering, like, even a couple years after you leave, when they do something that gets a lot of buzz, a lot of newsworthiness, do people on the street, people in the media say, "Hey, dude, what's going on with Deadspin?" as if you're still almost there in spirit?
Oh, it's you'd be amazed the number of people think I still am like a puppet master of that
right.
Side. It's like there, I won't name any names, but there was they ripped on one person in the media a few weeks ago, and that person contacted me. It kind of had the tone of, "Hey, can have those guys knock it off," or so on. And I'm like, literally, like, I have not, like, you know, when I was there, you know, it was me and my I'd get up from my bed and I have like a 10-step commute over to the desk, and that was the office. And now, you know, now they have staff meetings. They have a whole staff of people, most of which I've never met. A lot of them I like, but I like their work. I've never met those guys or anything. And I do always remember that, because, you know, Tommy, obviously AJ is a close friend of mine, and Tommy is a very good friend of mine. But someday Deadspin is going to be run by someone that I don't know and or doesn't like me. So I'm waiting for that to happen. I'm wondering if then I will get blamed for things. But
well, I'll tell you, you know, the same thing happens to Dan Patrick. We'll be out on the road or out at a restaurant, a bar or something, and some guy will walk up and go, "Dan Patrick, oh, it's so great to meet you. I love you. I watch you every night on SportsCenter." And Dan goes, "Still?" He goes, "Yeah, still." And Dan's like, "You know, I left there 7 years ago. I mean, it's not like I've been hiding out or do the occasional SportsCenter like once a month. I haven't done a SportsCenter in 7 years, but people still lock in him with that brand so strongly that people will come up to him and say, "Hey, ESPN did. What do you think of that?" And he'd be like, "Oh, I haven't worked there in 7 years. I do Football Night in America and the Olympics and a radio show." But he's still so associated, and even more so with Oberman. And he hasn't worked with Oberman on SportsCenter since the mid to late 90s.
Yeah, but it's true. Like, even I wrote a piece about your guys' show recently, and even I, who as a listener to the show and as someone that knows all the stuff that he's done, still felt compelled to start it with an Oberman thing. And I think that is... And I'm starting to accept it as I get older that, like, you know, no matter what happens, I'm just always going to be associated with Deadspin, which is fine. Like, I'm very happy. Like, I'm glad Deadspin got so much bigger after I left that, you know, I've talked to friends of mine who around in those early blog days, they would leave. They left, and then they would leave to go to some other job. And then the site after they left would kind of peter out. And so no one remembers.
Well, I think you could make a good comparison to Deadspin in your day and Dan with Keith, is that they were the big show. That's where you tuned in and the one place you went. And I think Deadspin was the same way back when you were there, kind of before you handed off. It's like you guys were the first dangerous sports blog, at least that's how I would characterize it, where it had a bit of like, "Oh, my gosh, what are they going to publish today?" or "Who are they going to take to task?" And now there's, you know, I would say, a dozen that are in that similar category of the same tone. Deadspin still does it the best. But that's like, you know, there's 100 of guys who've hosted sports centers throughout the years, but people still come up to Dan and Keith. Even just the other day, ESPN asked Dan to come back and do a one-timer sports center with Keith Olbermann. I guess there's still a market for it. It's pretty fascinating.
Are they going to do that?
I don't want to speak for Dan, but
right.
He said on the air the other day that he would likely not do it. You know, he understands that if they did one of those, like, way back machine sports center weeks like they did before. They did it maybe in 2003, and they brought back Kilbourne to do it with Dan, and everyone was surprised. Why wouldn't you bring back Olbermann? Well, back then, Olbermann was toxic, and nobody wanted to bring him back. Now, this time, Oberman's funny that Oberman's back in the mix full-time, and Dan is not toxic at all with people up in Bristol, but now they have to ask Dan to come back. NBC gave Dan, you know, the okay to do it if he wanted to. He doesn't think so. He kind of thinks that it'll be like trying to recreate something, like an old-timers game. You know, he's like, it was great when it happened. It was a 4 or 5 year great run. Let's just leave it as it is instead of, like, trying to dredge up old jokes and do the same bit, even though I think the fans would love it.
Yeah, you saw a little bit of that when they had that brief kind of crossover on the Sunday Night Football thing. But it was just, there was, first off, that crowd, that panel was so crowded. that it was hard for them to really have any time to do anything. And also, even then, you're just like, no, it's not. Everybody, if you guys are going to do this, everybody else off the stage and let them do it. And also, please make it 1994 again by Science or Magic.
Right, like, bring back Oberman's mustache. My suggestion to Dan was, and I suggested to the higher-ups at SportsCenter, what if you just had a day and only, like, John Skipper, the head of SportsCenter, Dan Patrick, and Keith Oberman knew that it was going to happen. No publicity, no anything. And just all of a sudden you turn on the 11 o'clock Tuesday night SportsCenter, and Scott Van Pelt and Neil Everett just decide to tap out after one highlight. Hey, let's bring in the backup crew, and they walk out and do it. Make it sneaky, and you know, nobody does that in the media. Everything's got to be promoted for months and sold and sponsored. But can you imagine if you're just tuning into the Tuesday night 11 o'clock, and here come Dan and Keith, just and they just bang out an hour and walk. And it was one of those things that would cause such a social media kind of breakout. It would be kind of cool.
Yeah, that would be. It would be very confusing. I have to make sure I'm not in the same like mental state that I was in like 1994. Like, I've got a bong and a bunch of Mad Dog 4040.
Right, you're sitting at some bar in Eastern Illinois looking for a ride home at 2 a.m, getting some Hardee's.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So you are. One of the things that you and I have bonded over in the past. You are a. You went to SIU. You're an SIU guy. I will say that. Most of my high school did not go to college, but the college that I would say most of the most commonly non-community college, which is the one in town that people went to, was SIU. You're from the Chicagoland area. What brought you to SIU?
I grew up in the South Side of Chicago, went to Marian Catholic, and most of my school did end up in college, and close, far away, a little bit of everything. I was going to go to Alabama, and I went down to visit Alabama, and I'm not even sure why I went there, probably for free football tickets, but I went down to visit there, and I got I saw a lot of racism firsthand down there, and it was overt. And I was like, boy, this may be a little too far south for me at age 17. And I was just kind of turned off by it. And I don't want to paint a brush against Alabama or the school because it's a great place. I've been there visiting. But at 17, I was like, you know what, I may want to go a little closer to home, but not, community college down the street from Chicago. And Southern Illinois is 5 hours away. It feels closer to Memphis than it does to Chicago. Mm-hmm. And it's a nice drive down there. I love driving past the cornfields. I would stop in Effingham at the Arby's on the way down, Mm-hmm. And SIU was a good school, good communications, school paper. The basketball team was good when I was there. And it was a fun place. I used to stop often at Eastern Illinois and visit a lot of my high school friends and have a good time there, too.
I like the idea that you were one of the rare people I've met that SIU was like your Berkeley. It's like, I need to move forward, man. I can't be backwards thinking. I need a progressive campus in Carbondale.
It was, though. It was kind of a little granola school when I got there.
It still kind of is.
People go there and they don't leave. It's not near a city. The school is as big as the town itself. The basketball was great when I got there. The football's got a lot better now. But I was there when we went to three straight national NCAA tournaments. Lost first round all three times. But it was a pretty good time to be there.
Who was the coach then?
It was a guy named Rich Heron. He was a longtime high school coach from Southern Illinois, and he coached forever there. We had some players that made the NBA, like Chris Carr, Ashraf Amaya. He had a cup of coffee in the pros. And after I left, Troy Hudson was there, and there's some good players. But the SIU arena was pretty good.
Yeah, I've never actually been to a game down there. I watched them closely. Of course, Bruce Weber coached both of our schools, and I still will always have a soft spot in my heart for Bruce Weber. I know that he got a lot of criticism from Illinois people. I remember when Illinois fired him, there was actually this notion because SIU had the job open that maybe he was going to go back to SIU. I think the K-State job is probably a little bit better of a fit, but I do like – I love that, and you see that. I explained this to a lot of people now that I live in Athens. It's very strange for me because – Illinois, like college basketball in Illinois is a much bigger deal than college football, with the exception of Notre Dame fans up around Chicago. Generally speaking, I think certainly downstate college basketball, man, and I feel like SIU was, which was bigger, basketball or football down there?
Yeah, I totally agree. I grew up in the South Side. I was much more of a high school basketball fan. My favorite school growing up was DePaul with Mark Aguirre and Terry Cummings and even to the Tommy Kleinschmidt days. And I also grew up loving Illinois basketball. I played a little grade school football with Kendall Gill. I knew a lot of the players. I used to go to a lot of Illinois Flying Illini games, and that was a great time to be a fan of their program. But it's not a football state after you let the Bears and Notre Dame go and the Big Ten. It really is a high school and college basketball state.
All right, so I want to talk about your job a little bit. How long you been doing the show?
I've been with Dan Patrick on the Dan Patrick Show. I started ESPN 2000. I worked on the College Game Day and NFL shows on radio. In 2002, Dan asked me to produce his show, and I worked with Dan from 02 to 05 or so. I left for about a year and a half. I did TV, which I didn't really care for as much, and I did 1 year at Sirius XM Radio with Tony Stewart during the NASCAR show, which Tony was a great guy. And then when Dan decided to leave ESPN in May of 07, he called me up. He goes, "Hey, can you meet me down at the bar for beer and wings? We live pretty close to each other." And he said, "I'm thinking about leaving ESPN, starting my own thing." And he kind of laid out the game plan. And I go, "Who knows about this?" He goes, "Me, you, and my wife." And I go, "Have you made the decision yet?" He goes, "About 90%. And I said, "I love it." He goes, "You want to join in? I said, "Absolutely." So I joined back in with him in 07. We brought a couple people from ESPN, like Todd Fritz and Patrick O'Connor, Seton O'Connor on the show. And then we grabbed Andrew Perloff from Sports Illustrated. And we've been together since 07.
Yeah, you guys, I think of all the things, when we did that show, it was obviously a little scary and intimidating to be on the air and doing all that, particularly because that was when you guys had first started going on DirecTV. So it was very, right. It was very disorienting. I had
cameras.
Yeah, we had Michael Schur from then known mostly from The Office, now from Parks Recreation and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He was one of the guests on the show, and he
right.
did, and all he did when he most of the time to talk was he would just occasionally interject to make fun of my hair or to make fun of something, say what I was doing. Like that is kind of disorienting. But I think what we actually found most intimidating was we felt we were intruding on some sort of in someone's house. The way that your studio are having, the way you guys are kind of set up, like almost this kind of family structure, we kind of felt like it put us in a situation where we felt like we needed to take our shoes off when we walked in, and we didn't knock anything over.
We do kind of have a clubhouse feel to here. It kind of feels like a, you know, maybe a more polite fraternity. We set up this radio show. We consider ourselves a radio show that's on TV, not a TV show that just dabbles in radio. We try to really respect the craft of radio first. But you also look at a lot of those radio shows that are on TV, and they have two cameras, one with two guys in it, and then they have two single shots of each other. That's kind of boring. And it's really boring television. And you see those shows, and you know the ones I'm talking about, and it's just very stagnant. And Dan goes, "I don't want to do that. If I'm going to do TV, I want to make it big and broad." And we have 11 cameras in here. We put tape over the red lights so we don't know what cameras are on. And all the cameras are controlled by our control room in Los Angeles with DirecTV. So it's more like the Truman Show, where we're a bunch of gerbils in a cage, and they're showing what we do, the bad, the good, the ugly. And if we make a mistake, we try to talk about it and embrace it, and because the listener's gonna, the viewer's gonna let you know when you make a mistake. And if someone catches me scratching my ear and knuckle deep during a segment, we'll all show it on TV and make fun of it.
I'm curious some of the worst guests you've had. I remember as a Cardinals fan, I feel like Whitey Herzog, of course, I think is somewhat famous one over there. I interviewed Whitey Herzog one time, and he's one of those guys that you interview and you're like, "Oh man, he's gonna say something racist. Oh, he's gonna say something racist." Like, and he didn't say anything racist, but he just kind of got that tone, like, you know, that you're fishing with your great grandfather. Something's gonna there's a slur's coming out just because that's the way he talked. I know he didn't do that on your show, of course, but like he famously, I think that was even just confusing. I don't think even really everyone understood why he was so upset. But what are the most like memorable kind of contentious things that have happened during your time?
Well, Whitey Herzog, in the notes for the book he had, it said he would talk about the Cardinals back in the day, and if you remember, but a lot of people may not, that they had some cocaine troubles and with a lot of their star players in the early 80s. And so when Dan brought up the topic, he goes, I'm not here to talk about that. And Dan goes, it's literally in the notes of what you're going to talk about. And Dan goes, I'm not here to talk about that. And he hung up. And then another time we had Tanya Harding on, and Dan never talked to Tanya Harding, the skater. And he starts asking her about Nancy Kerrigan. And she goes, "Well, I'm not going to talk about that." And Dan's like, "Well, what else are we going to talk about? You can't talk about your boxing career for 11 minutes. I'll pub that you have a boxing match coming up. We have to talk about it." But some people are just inaudible, and you know they're not engaged. There's some athletes that just, they don't want to be there, which I don't understand why you do an interview if you're going to give one and two-word answers. I guess some people just don't have the ability yet to really cut loose. And I also think my favorite interviews are the ones where people surprise you, and someone's gregarious and you didn't expect it, or forthcoming where you didn't expect it.
You know, I also briefly, you know, you obviously have association with the NBC Sports Network, and you and I were actually guests together on Michelle Beadle's show.
Yep.
Now, you know more, again, you know a lot more about TV than me, and I think that show is considered Like it didn't work or so, and then she's actually left and going back to ESPN. I have to say, and this is maybe why I'm really bad at television, I actually didn't think that show was that bad, and I didn't even think it was that bad of an idea. Maybe she, you know, maybe there may have been backstage stuff. I don't really know about any of that. But I'm curious, and you know, you were on that show as well. Do you like doing TV? Did you like that show? Like, I get confused about how that stuff works because I'm, you know, I sit in a room and type, and occasionally I put a camera on me and I talk really fast, and everyone has to cut around it. I'm curious, like, what was that experience like? What do you think of situations like that?
Well, I actually never wanted to be on air or on TV with the Dan Patrick Show. Kind of happened by accident. And if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it as best I can, which I'm not Dan Patrick or Bob Costas, or I'm not ever going to try to be. But I want to cut loose and have fun on the air. Let's try to ask some questions that are original and not just phone it in. I think with Beetle, you got to give her less structure, not more. She's kind of a wild card, and you should embrace that. You don't put wooden shoes on a racehorse. You kind of let them cut loose. And when I went on the show with Beetle, and you did too, we would just cut loose and have a conversation. Let the cameras find you. A lot of times on TV, there's a lot of stuff that's scripted. If you watch different segments on different sports shows, you'll see, let's ask whatever expert about the Colts, and I'll have a piece of B-roll ready for the Colts. Well, it's a bunch of scripted questions, and it feels like filler. I just want TV to be a little memorable. When you get done watching a show or listening to a show or whatever it may be, if you don't remember anything from it, then it's just white noise and filler. And if you want to have something that's a little memorable, even for a couple minutes after the show. I'm no expert in TV, but I want to be entertained, and I want to be able to entertain the people in the room, the people outside the room listening. I want Dan Patrick to be entertained at the end of his day. I want him to walk out of the room and say, hey, you know what, we did something today, not just, hey, we got 3 hours done. Sports radio, sports TV shouldn't be a labor. It is work, but it shouldn't be feel like you're roofing houses.
You know, I want to get really excited about all of these kind of new networks. I've done stuff with NBC, and I've done some stuff for Fox Sports Live, and I like... Part of me wants to get excited about this because there's, you know, this is something that even in the early days of Deadspin we were saying for the longest time. It wasn't so much that no one thought that ESPN was full of evil people trying to do evil things. It was that, you know, they once you kind of had so much market share, you don't really have, like, you know, then the only place to grow is to go after the lowest common denominator and kind of move in that direction. Now, I think they've up with Grantland and 30 for 30 and 538. I think they've made like smart moves in that way. But for me, it was exciting for me to see, okay, there's all these other stations. We can try all these other things. And I know they've had a lot of struggles. But to me, I'm always reminded there's this theory among economists who always say that, you know, we get all fired up about presidential elections, who's winning, right, who's running, who's got the electoral college. The fact is, if people feel optimistic about the economy, they vote for the incumbent, and if they don't, they don't. Right. And that's just the way it works. I feel like that about television, that the reason ESPN has all this power right now is because they have all the sports.
Yes. Everything's about being a rights holder. And let's not kid each other. If ESPN suddenly lost the NFL and college football, do you think people would be tuning into all their shows all day? No, you go to where the college football and pro football are, or the NBA packages. They built this huge brand, and they've got deep pockets to have a lot of rights, and it's working for them. But if you look at, I'm not showing any favoritism for NBC Sports Network, but I do work for them in some way. They've embraced hockey. And they're going to embrace NASCAR, and they've embraced the Premier League Soccer. They've doubled the Premier League Soccer ratings off Fox last year because they really surrounded it with good shows. And now, while NASCAR and soccer and hockey are never going to be the NFL or NBA, well, those are good rights to have, and they've gotten some good ratings off them. And the same with NBA. If you look at baseball, I'm sorry, ESPN, they do have good shows, and they got shows that are kind of vanilla and milquetoast. But sometimes simple is the best. If you look at Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon, PTI came about because I used to work on the Kornheiser show for a brief time. Almost every commercial break during the Tony Kornheiser radio show, Wilbon would call in and ask me to pass through to Tony, not on the air, off the air, and he'd be like, Tony, what are you thinking? How could you say, and he just would lay into him for like 45 seconds, and he'd be like, Wilbon, get out of here, leave me alone, I'm doing a show, and you don't know, and they would argue, and it was the most entertaining thing. And then some producer at ESPN just pressed a button and put that feed of Kornheiser and Wilbon on the internet. It was kind of like this behind-the-scenes show, and this is what Kornheiser Wilbon did all day. And as smart as Rideholm is and the producers of PTI is, they kept it simple. It's Tony, it's Mike, it's sports topics, let them go.
Yeah, and to me, I love Pardon the Interruption, I love their interaction with each other. The problem is what spawned from that, because not everybody has the chemistry that Michael Wilbon and Tony Kornheiser have, who have been working together for years and years.
Will, you could smell forced chemistry.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I mean. But like, and now, you know, now I think as I think 30 Rock had the great line of, you know, sports shouting. They had the show that they called sports shouting. Now it does feel like that a little bit. Do you think that's just, is that just cheap filler? Like, are those shows, you know, I feel like there's a difference between Around the Horn, which I have to say in recent years I've warmed up to a little bit, if just because of some of the alternatives. But you look at like, you know, it feels like a lot of times there are shows put on now for the lowest hanging fruit. And I wonder about how that just makes us feel about sports television. What makes the average viewer feel about when 30 Rock, who's not, you know, is not a sports show, when they look, turn on sport, their reaction to turning on a sports channel is sports shouting or sports sesh, as was on Eastbound and Down. I'm wondering about how that even affects the whole industry.
Yeah, it's tough. I know what we're talking about here. We're talking about First Take at ESPN, and it's an easy target because it's a very simple concept. They're yelling at each other. They're not that much different than PTI. They have a moderator instead of a rundown on the side. It does feel concocted. It does feel sometimes scripted, but they are getting a truckload of ratings, and so somebody has to be watching it. Nobody, as much as we say in the sports media, oh, I don't watch that show, it's beneath me.
Somebody's
watching it. Right. It's like McDonald's. McDonald's doesn't stay in business because they don't sell burgers. But then again, you don't have to participate in it. I'm sure there's things as a producer on my show I could do to get more ratings. We could have talked more Tebow, or we could talk more Favre back in the day. We're not holier than now. We talk Tebow, we talk Favre, we talk Manziel. But when you create scenarios to talk about Johnny Manziel instead of covering Johnny Manziel, that's where I have an issue. When there's a, you know, I think there was a topic maybe a year ago, Tim Tebow, what would he do in the Panthers offense? There was no rumor that he was going to join the Panthers. There was nothing to it. There was not even a scintilla of a rumor that he was going to join the Carolina Panthers. Like, well, why would you even bring this up? This isn't covering sports. This is concocting sports.
Yeah, and but you know, it's nevertheless, it's people are watching. I guess it's a maturation of sports television that you have people complaining about shows that get canceled and complaining about the shows that stay on the air. Maybe that's the Two and a Half Men.
Well, that's the thing, Will. If you ever pitch a show and it's on for a short period of time and it gets canceled, that's cool. You want to be like Arrested Development. If a lot of people watch it, that's not cool. So cancellation is a way to be cool, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You liked it before other people knew, after it got canceled. Yeah, that's not that you don't. You want to be able to watch the show before it got canceled.
Right. Then 5 years from now, our when you and I run the crossover with Beetle, it's gonna be a legendary.
Oh yeah, it's gonna be like Freaks
video.
And Geeks. It's gonna be Freaks and Geeks. They're gonna be like, yeah. Oh yeah, it came back. They'll be calling for the three of us to come back on the show.
Yeah, it's be like the Basquiat of sports TV.
Exactly. My job, I loved it because my job on that show, I felt very comfortable because I think she's extremely talented and I think she's very smart and I think she's really great. So I felt like my job on the, I was the Ed McMahon. I was very happy to be the Ed McMahon and just like let her run and then laugh along. I can do that job. If there's other people doing all the heavy lifting and I have to laugh at their jokes, I'm really good at that.
Well, I'm gonna give you an honest admission here. Like, when you and I were on a panel together, I've known you for a little while now, and, you know, we've been around in the same industry for a while. But some people, when you work in TV, and remember, I'm a producer first, and you're a writer first, or we're kind of TV guys, we step into it. But there's some people, when you get on a panel with them or you get in a discussion with them, there's almost an intimidation factor. You come off like a very intelligent, well-spoken guy, and you're a fast talker. That's something that's tough to deal with if you're on the other side of the couch, because, like, do I try to keep up with somebody, or do I just do my thing? We had Bomani Jones on the other day. You know Bomani Jones is around the horn. He's a great writer.
He's great.
Bomani Jones is one of the most intelligent people I've ever heard on any outlet of TV. He speaks faster and more intelligently than I could ever hope to, and I found it almost, like, depressing. I was like, oh, my gosh, I don't think I could go back to an Ivy League school for a decade. I don't think I could gain that level of glibness and deep thought all at the same time. And, you know, it's also kind of cool to have him on the show. You're like, that guy is a star. That guy's a guy who's going to shake things up. I don't know what Bomani Jones' future is in this industry, but I'm excited about it. That guy's he's not predictable in any way. When he opens his mouth, I don't know what's going to happen. And there's guys like that, like Dan Le Batard. I've been a fan of Le Batard. I worked on a Le Batard show for a little bit when I was at ESPN. I've always been a big fan of his because I don't know what he's going to say. When I turn on his radio show, him and Stu Gotson, the guys on ESPN, I don't know what's going to happen. And I love the non-predictability. Are there shows that are more traditional sports talk and coverage? Sure. But I kind of know what I'm going to get. It's like they're the specials board at a great restaurant. Oh, man, check this out. And that's when guys like Bomani, Le Batard, you, Deadspin, other places like that. That's why I tune into them, because I don't know what I'm going to get.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like I actually am pretty certain that Bomani Jones is going to be, like, we're all going to be working for him someday.
I agree, man. He's too bright.
He's, like, way too good. Okay, my last question for you, and I like Levitard too, by the way.
you had to say that in there. Or if Levitard will text me, why didn't Will say anything about me?
One of my favorite Levitard things, I don't know him well. I remember I went on his show when Deadspin was, like, 3 or 4 months old, and I'm not particularly great now on radio or television, but then I was really bad, and I'd also had forgotten about the interview, so I'd been in a bar, and I came on, and it was like a Saturday afternoon, and they pre-taped, and I came on, and I hope it's not taped anywhere. I didn't curse or anything, but it's really just like, I sound like, you know how occasionally the film critic Dana Stevens the other day, she for a couple hours all of a sudden just weird shit started coming out of her Twitter, and because like her 9-year-old daughter had like got on and started typing things. That's what my radio sounded like. That's what my Dan Levitard. And so I went on like a couple years later, and he was so nervous to have me on. He's like, well, someone talked to you, right? You're like a little better. I was like, I'm not crying in the middle of the interview with you.
Well, I'll tell you, there's someone else like that. Bill Simmons. Bill Simmons is kind of a legend now, but back in 2004 when the Red Sox won the World Series, I was on the Dan Patrick Show, and I go, we should have Bill Simmons on. Back then, Bill Simmons was just the sports guy who wrote. He was not 30 by 30 Bill Simmons. He was not the powerhouse, the guy who's on TV and radio all over the place. He had never done a radio interview before at ESPN at all. And I got him on the phone, and he kind of sounded like almost like a George Costanza. He's like, I don't know if I want to. I was like, what? He goes, the Red Sox won. I'm excited, but I don't know if I want to go on, Dan. And I couldn't even hear the guy. And we ended up talking him into coming on, and he was very aloof and quiet, and he was all like that. And now he's known for being really kind of a flamethrower, but kind of a unique voice. And he's never really bought into the, I'm going to be the well-spoken broadcaster guy. He's just himself, and he's just better at being himself, more clearly spoken. But back then, if you'd have told me this guy's going to be a media star on air, I'd have been like, well, maybe, I don't know.
Well, that's what Ron Wexler, who was our producer on the Beatles show, is a friend of mine as well. That's his thing about this always. He's like, it's just reps. You just have to do it more and more and more and more and more. But that's why the fast speaking thing is always a problem for me, because I don't think I'm talking fast.
Right there is the slowest thing you said. You slowed down and said, I don't think I'm talking fast.
And it's just funny, because to me, I felt like, oh, I put 10 seconds between every word right there. Like, it is so hard. Like, I don't think I'm talking fast at all, but apparently the rest of you people are listening too slow.
Well, Dan Patrick actually taught me a cool little tip. I'm sure someone taught him. And sometimes by slowing down and dropping your voice, you could enunciate and people hear what you say better. So let's say I was like, the LA Lakers, they got no chance to get a new coach. I think they're going to lose all of their games next year, and they're going to be in the lottery again. Now Dan goes, what if you said it this way? I think the LA Lakers are awful, and next year they're going to be in the lottery again. Now you can be too hokey and do that too often and go to that too much, but by slowing it down and less is more, it sometimes works, I guess.
Yeah, it was funny. I did, right after the Chris Cluey, piece was on Deadspin this year, I was actually on Fox Sports Live for that night, and he was actually a guest on that show. And so Charissa Thompson, she's also very good, and they thought, because, I'd been with Deadspin, and I had written about gays in sports a lot, they thought it would be ideal to have me on interview him together. So it was very funny. So I, of course, I've interviewed tons of people, and I know how to ask questions, but I know how to ask questions when I'm on television, when I'm for an interview, or maybe on maybe on a podcast. But for me, so I give him this like long-winded, so in the spectrum of the world of sports and where things started and where they are now, where do you think? And then they go over to Trisha Thompson. She's like, what happened? When was this? What's happening now? Who said what? And like, I'm like, right, that's how you do this.
Less is more.
Yeah, that's how it's done. And I will never be able to do that, which is why I will only be hosting this podcast. Okay, my last question for you.
Okay.
Because you and I wrote recently about, I was really surprised that no one had written about Dan Patrick's constant appearances in Adam Sandler movies. This is because I made the joke. It's kind of a joke, but it's not really a joke. Is that like this is the closest we have to like when Hitchcock would have cameos in his own movies. Like nobody really does this other than Tarantino, who will like pop up as a with a horrible Australian accent or on the answering machine in Jackie Brown. We really don't have like. There's not a lot of the movie business is too weird and too confused. There's not a lot of people that have the type of power to be like, okay, I want this guy to. This guy's just going to have a role in my movies no matter what. And yeah. So, it's just true. There just aren't a lot of people in the movie business like that. So I'm curious, and that, of course, that was why AJ and I had filled on in the first place because that was the time that he was filming the movie. I'm curious. First off, how did that start? Do you, and more importantly, do you have a favorite appearance? Is there one that you think, do you see him getting better? Do you see him getting more roles? I'm curious, just your take of watching him in these movies.
Well, there's a lot to get to there. Back in the late 90s, Keith Olbermann was supposed to be in Waterboy, and Keith had a commitment he couldn't get out of, and Sandler called Dan and said, could you do Waterboy? And Dan's like, yeah. I don't think Dan had ever been in a movie. I think he was in... briefly in a Hootie and a Blowfish video, believe it or not.
I remember that.
And, yeah. And so Dan did it. They ended up hanging out for a couple of days, had a great time. And then the next time he did a movie, and I wish I could remember the order of it, he said, do you want to be a cop? And Dan's like, and he goes, Dan, do you want to play someone besides yourself? And Dan goes, yes. I don't want to be Dan Patrick. I want to be anybody but me, bad guy, good guy. So he played a cop in House Bunny. He played a cop in Longest Yard remake. He was just in Blended, which is out now, and he plays the father of one of the girls, and he was like a band leader in and Just Go With It. Sandler's one of those guys. He has a group around him, as you can imagine, a really tight old school guys, the guys he sticks with, and he puts a lot of them in his movies. And I think Adam has, you know, I don't even know how to say this phrase the right way, carte blanche. he could do what he wants, and he calls Dan. Dan has never, you know, sometimes he lobbies for it on the show. It's like a running gag. But the movie Just Go, That's My Boy with Sandler, mm-hmm. Sarandon, and Sandberg, he asked us if we want to be extras. We played Dan's film crew in the prison, and we got to shoot for 2 days. And, I mean, I know the movie wasn't, Gone with the Wind, but it was fun. It was a great time, and there was a lot of great jokes in the movie. And to see the process was really, really fascinating, all the ad-libbing and how Sandler just runs the whole show.
It does seem like he's getting bigger roles. Each time he's got a couple more lines. Like, there's actually two of the movies he's been in. He's actually the guy that sets the plot in motion.
Yeah, and it sure was. But the one I thought was the biggest, when he was on Just Go With It, he had a scene where he was on stage with Susan Sarandon.
Nicole Kidman.
Nicole Kidman and Jennifer Aniston. These are major celebrities. And neither of them knew who the hell Dan Patrick was. All they knew is he was the sports dude who's friends with Adam. And the same thing happened on the set of Just Go With It. That's My Boy. We're standing there, and Sandler is talking sports with me, McLovin, Fritzy, and Seton from the show. And Susan Sarandon's standing there looking at us like, who the hell are these four extras? And why would Adam Sandler be spending his time talking to them? And Andy Samberg was in the same boat. I think Andy knows a little about sports, but I don't think he's a regular watcher of the Dan Patrick show. And they're just kind of staring like, why would anyone be talking to the extras? And it was kind of surreal. And Susan Sarandon, you could just tell, had no idea. She couldn't have been nicer, but she didn't know who we were.
Well, I guess her sports knowledge stopped with the 94 Rangers. I think that's probably a fair assessment. All right, thanks, man. This was really fun. I appreciate your time. I know that it is valuable. You're a busy man, but this was really fun. And if you'll do me the honor, I'd love to chat with you again sometime, maybe before the next Illinois SIU football game.
Absolutely, Will. It's great. I'm glad you're down in SEC country. You're going to learn how to use a smoker or grill. I can't wait.
I'm doing is burning kale. I'm still adjusting from life in Brooklyn.
Oh, not kale. That's illegal in Georgia. You get arrested for having kale in your house.
I was wondering what the SWAT team was doing here.
Wrap it in meat and hide it in meat. No one will bother you. Take it easy, buddy.
Of course. Thanks, man. All right. Thank you to Paul Papps. That was really fun. He's the producer of the Dan Patrick Radio Show, which you should be listening to. It's on everywhere. You really can't miss it. You can also, of course, see it. I think it's simulcast on the NBC Sports Network. So there you go. Anyway, you can follow him on Twitter at Paul Papps, PaulPabst. This has been the Will Leach Experience Podcast. The music is by the Sundogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Monday's guest will be Joe D'Alessio, Sports on Earth hockey writer. He's going to probably preview the Stanley Cup finals. We should know by then, depending on whether or not... I think we'll know by then. Yeah, so we'll be previewing the Excuse me, we'll be in the Stanley Cup, and I think we're going to go baseball probably the rest of the week before we do a week full of World Cup shows. Excuse me. Anyway, so thank you. Have a wonderful weekend. Be safe out there, and I'll talk to you and Joe and the rest of the planet on Monday. Take care.